Interview with Gary Lynch, July 19th, 2006, at Morgan Stanley in New York City by Kenneth Durr.
I'm interested in starting out more or less to the beginning and getting a little bit of background on how you got to the FEC. I understand that that was close to being one of your first jobs.
Yeah, I was at a law firm. Okay. And joined the SEC. A little over a year out of law school, and joined it in the enforcement division. So immediately started doing investigations.
Was there some reason that you got into that?
It was one of those, I can't say that it was like one of the things that I necessarily wanted to do coming out of law school, but I had someone I had worked with as a summer associate between my second and third year of law school was working at the SEC. She had moved from a law firm to working for the commission and loved it, so she encouraged me to look there.
She was in enforcement?
Yeah.
Okay, so you knew that that's what you wanted.
Yeah, I did also, and also I was interested in litigation, so it was most similar kind of function to a litigation job.
So you worked for Stanley Sporkin.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about that.
What kind of department did you run? It was a I joined in the time of the foreign payoff, sort of the foreign payoff era.
How he made his.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was receiving a lot of attention as I was coming onto the staff. But in fact, I think I only did two foreign corrupt practices cases. For the most part, I did, started out doing manipulation cases. And then insider trading cases, and then along with that, change of control cases, so tender offer, proxy contest kind of cases. So.
We're looking at the late 70s.
Well, I joined in 76. By 78, I can't tell you when in 78. Sometime during in the year 78, I became a branch chief. And started supervising cases. So relatively soon after, within 2 years of joining the staff, I was a supervisor.
In Washington,
yeah. Working for Ed Herlihy, who in turn reported to Ted Levine, who in turn reported to Stanley Sporkin. That was not the group I was in originally. I was in another group, but when there was a reorganization, and they created a couple of new branches, and so I was moved over to work with Ed and Ted.
Okay, and they had a good bit of experience in insider trading.
People didn't really have a lot of experience with insider trading in 78 when we started doing that. I mean, there was a handful of cases.
Any of those notable?
I was thinking of that in preparation for talking to you. I think the one thing that I would note, most of those cases were small cases. In the 78, 79 time frame. And it wasn't until the Swiss cases, the Santa Fe case and St. Joe case, that the numbers started getting pretty large.
So we're looking at
$10,000, $20,000, $50,000 cases for the most part. And there was, Texas Gulf Sulphur in the 60s. So, yeah, I mean, there were some insider trading cases, but there just weren't that many. And then in 78 or so, that's when there started to become more of those. And most of those were concentrated in the Ted Levine, Ed Herlihy group. And I did them, I did a few of them, and there was another branch chief by the name of Jim Mann, who worked for Ed, who was doing insider trading cases. But it wasn't, you know, there were some, but there weren't, you know, it wasn't a heavy batch of them. And that really, that, in my recollection, is the cases started getting bigger and more numerous in the sort of 81 time frame.
Okay. Was this before John Shad uttered his famous
pronouncement? Yeah, this all started when Harold Williams was still the chairman. And Stanley Sporkin was the director.
So you were quite aware that something was happening to create all these new insider cases and watching them develop.
Yeah, although I would date it more with the big foreign trading cases, the Swiss or other foreign bank trading cases, where the numbers were much larger than in the other cases.
Well, you were involved with the Santa Fe case.
I was not really. I was involved on the periphery of Santa Fe. I'm trying to. I don't know that. I don't think Santa Fe came out of my group. I think it came out of another group. I was involved as the St. Joe was out of New York, as I recall. I think Santa Fe was out of Washington. I think it was Michael Mann worked on that. Well, that can't be, because if Michael Mann worked on it, then it would be in my group, because Michael Mann worked with me.
These groups you're talking about, is this just
the branches, you know.
Groups of people take different cases?
Yeah. Yeah, and there was no, you know, there was no real assignment system. Was just,
so you're not specialized?
Well, no. Well, actually, my group in when it was formed in 78 was the, I think it was called Changes in Corporate Control. And it was supposed to focus on Williams Act and proxy cases, which it did, but since most of the insider trading cases related to tender offers and proxy contests, so it was a good dose of insider trading as well.
I don't suppose anybody foresaw that, though, back when that was created.
I think by 78 there were run-ups. The period of big takeover activity was starting. And accelerated, obviously, as you went into the 80s. But I don't think there was I don't think one of the branches was the branch of insider trading, although that was 26 years ago. Yeah, so I don't, there could very well have been. But Ted Levine and Ed Herlihy, at least in the Washington office, the home office, tended to do most of the insider trading cases. In fact, I remember there was some, particularly as the insider trading cases got more attention, there was some resentment of that as to whether or not they should be farmed around the division more.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I've heard almost the opposite, that people sometimes weren't interested because they were hard to...
Early on. Yeah, I'm talking by the time you got...
85.
Yeah, 85, 86, then insider trading cases were deemed to be, you know, interesting cases to work on.
People were getting pictures in the paper.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess the big thing I want to pull out of this period, though, is, was it in any way a surprise that this developed? Or were people watching it and expecting this insider trading glut? How much did the SEC anticipate? How much did it just react?
Well, it was certainly reactive by the time you got into the 80s. You were reacting to, you know, huge option trading. I mean, the thing that I think that really exposed it as a real abuse was less the stock trading and much more the option trading.
That was the Santa Fe case.
Santa Fe and St. Joe were both big options trades, although, you know, most of the tender offer cases, if there were listed options available, that's where the big activity was. So obviously, because of the leverage afforded by the options, but so you know, it kind of slapped you in the face when you just saw the huge you know, volume and options. And obviously, the whether it was the SIBO or the Amex, you know, people were getting burned badly on the floor who were on the other side of these big option trades. So.
Was there I know that the Chiarella case was an 8.
Yeah.
Right? Which sort of set the, in one sense, knocked the props out from under how everybody had been prosecuting or setting up the credit trading case.
Mm-hmm.
Around that time period, was there a sense from the people who were handling these cases that, you know, what are we going to do? How are we going? Was there a grappling for new ways to approach it?
After Chiarella, yes. The misappropriation theory developed. Prior to that time, it was, you know, there really wasn't a focus on the duty issue. And then afterwards, obviously after Chiarella, where it was, you know, it wasn't enough to just merely possess inside information. You had to show it was in violation of a duty of trust or confidence. And misappropriation developed. I think going into that, you know, I don't recall people spending a lot of time thinking, well, gee, we're on really thin ice with the legal theory here. And then when Chiarella came in, it didn't take long to develop, you know, the misappropriation theory, which became sort of the central theory on which these cases were prosecuted.
How much did you and your people actually think about these theories?
Well, we thought a lot about them after Chiarella. I think going into Chiarella, and maybe there was someone in the commission who was thinking a lot about it, but basically the focus was on, you know, you showed someone had confidential information, showed that it was material, and there wasn't a lot of focus on showing how, you know, that they got it through inappropriate means.
Texas Gulf Sulphur essentially said, hey, you know, if it's insider information, then it's
Yeah, exactly. So it's. But on the other hand, I think the I don't know how many weeks it took to develop misappropriation and proceed with that, but it was, you know, it wasn't like it was a long hiatus between the time Chiarella came down and other insider trading cases were brought.
Well, I know some of this was coming out of the cases in the district courts and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Transition from Williams, and I guess insider trading, some concern about insider trading is already starting.
Yeah.
And of course, Shad sort of decides to make his name on that.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about, I mean, you've discussed what was happening, what you were seeing as far as the increase. What were some of the other things behind Shad's decision to go that way?
Well, I think, you know, John spent his life on Wall Street prior to coming to the commission, and he had a gut feel that insider trading was rampant. And I'm just trying to think of the timing of it. When did he come in with you know, in relation to St. Joe and Santa Fe? Probably right around the same time, but as I said, you know, the big option trading cases, you couldn't help but see, you know, suddenly something that didn't trade traded, you know, 2,000 option contracts the day before the announcement. Didn't take genius to figure out there was something amiss. But he had a view that it was, you know, that it was more prevalent than that, even that there were a lot of people trading, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks before.
Did you find that to be the case?
Oh, I think the more we got into it, yeah, definitely. I mean, it was, but it was, you know, it was, you know, I think of the, you know, sort of the real focus on insider trading beginning with the Swiss cases with the big numbers. So whether it was 80 or 81, somewhere in that time frame, and continuing into 85 when I became director. You know, at that point, it hadn't abated at all, you know, frankly. It was just, if anything, the run-ups were still as big, and there was a lot of stock trading, some option trading. but it was, you know, it was still a huge problem. And that was in spite of the fact that there were some fairly notorious prosecutions during that period even, and still didn't seem to affect conduct. People were still willing to take the risk. You know, during the Foster Winans case came along in 84 or so. Paul Thayer, the former chairman and CEO of LTV, who was Deputy Secretary of Defense when we brought the case.
You had a couple of Reagan appointees.
Seems to me there was one other.
Reed?
Yeah, Tom Reed. I brought that. Actually, I that was a case I developed, I think, as a branch chief.
Okay.
Yeah, that was early on.
Well, tell me about that one a little bit.
Yeah, that was early on. I forgot, you know, I would, unless you mentioned that, I would have forgotten about it completely. Tom Reed. You know, I don't even remember what the trading was in. I just remember it was a fairly big case at that time. A little thing stick in my mind. I remember it was from Walnut Creek, California. Unless I'm confusing with another case, but I think it was Walnut Creek, California. And I don't even remember what the source was of the information now. I just remember that that was a big case.
Did most of these come out of a tip to somebody saying, "Hey, look at this?"
No, they almost all came out of surveillance by the exchanges. You know, you didn't need, you know, for the big option trades, you didn't need sophisticated surveillance. But, you know, as time went on stock trades, there was a lot of surveillance, you know, the 2, 3, or 4 week period prior to the announcement. And I think it's fair to say we got better doing that, and exchanges got better doing that as time went on. But you'd get back, I remember back then, you'd get, you know, you'd blue sheet a stock, which means you'd ask for, you know, who was the buyer and seller of the stock, and you know, some stuff would come in with handwriting, where people would fill them in. Even at major firms, they'd be filled in by hand, which, you know, you think about today,
yeah,
how crazy that is, you know, because now it's all done, basically on automated basis. The request goes out automated, comes back automated, so much much easier to analyze the information.
Seems a little late in the day for that, even back in the 80s.
Yeah, I don't know when that ended, but I remember looking at hand blue sheets when I was a young staff lawyer that were in handwriting coming back.
So you think a lot of this would involve just crunching numbers and looking at how the numbers work.
Yeah, and a lot of it was just looking at sort of gut feel. You look at it and say, gee, that's a big trade. What is that person doing? You know, another big case was Barry Switzer. Remember the football coach?
Yeah, that one of yours too?
You know, I don't know if Barry Switzer was one of mine or not. I was involved. I may have been the associate director at that by the time that was brought. I may have been brought out of a regional office, I think, even. But
that was one of those cases people like to invoke, the hearing the tip on the public place and how you prove that.
Yeah, that's what I think it was. I think it was out of the Fort Worth. I think did they eventually lose that case? I don't know. Can't even remember. I do remember, though, there was all, you know, that one was obvious that there was all this trading out of Oklahoma prior to a major announcement. But a lot of it was just looking, you know, at zip codes and seeing concentration of trading and taking it from there. And Paul Thayer was, you know, he was trading out of Dallas, Texas area.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about that case, because that's probably one of the first ones that really gets the headlines for the commission.
Yeah, that got a lot of headlines, and round about the same time, I can't remember which one was first, the Winans case got a lot of headlines as well, mainly because the press made it into such a cause celeb. I mean, the initial take of most newspapers on that was that the commission was somehow invading freedom of the press.
Of the Winans case.
Yeah. It was a huge uproar in the several weeks after it was first brought. I remember that, you know, this is back at a time where the public relations office was, you know, not as well staffed and probably not quite as sophisticated as I'm sure it is today. But I remember, you know, developing the mantra, which I just delivered over and over again: there's no First Amendment right to defraud. And just saying that over and over again, as a, you know, defending our bringing of the case against the reporter. But, you know, the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press filed amicus briefs, and there was, I remember, there was a big editorial in the New York Times. It became a very big issue.
I would think reporters would be interested in quite the opposite, in seeing, you know, in not having people making money off of their stories.
Yeah, I could never figure out why they everyone got so whipped up about it, but boy, it was, I mean, if you, just for fun, if you want to go back now and take a look at, it would be easy to find from the commission records when that case was first brought. Take a look at the New York Times editorial. I remember because it was a stinging. I remember also going back and being challenged by the commission about, you know, were we trying to, you know, was this, were the first real First Amendment issues here that we somehow walked into?
Yeah. This was when the commission sitting down, and were you generally sitting in on those?
Well, yeah, this was, yeah, the close.
Were you director of enforcement?
No, I was not. I was associate director, but the director of enforcement, John Fetters at the time, was recused on the case. So I was the most senior person in the commission who was in the enforcement division who was working on it. I think his old law firm, Arlen Porter, was representing someone. So he was not in the case. But yeah, you know, I think back on this huge hoopla, though, about the whether there were First Amendment rights that were somehow implicated.
Yeah, I've seen the newspaper stories. I guess I always wondered how genuine that was, or whether.
Oh, it was a big deal. Oh, I remember meetings with people. Number of meetings where a variety of lawyers came in representing one reporter's group or another about, you know, what we were doing, and I think that was the whole concept of. You know, it, trying to get behind why an article was being written. So I think that was as concerning as the fact that the article was going to be in print. The fact that, you know, why did Foster Winans think that, you know, some stock was going to go down or go up? And what right did the commission have to probe his sources into that? Which was a secondary issue, obviously. The real issue was that his friend knew what was going to be in the paper the next day, so when he went out and bought stock or shorted it or whatever. But
the Thayer case,
I think Thayer was a little earlier, actually.
I think it was. Yeah. It seems like the Santa Fe case, of course, just wasn't quite that sexy. I mean, there was a lot.
It was more of a lawyer case. It was a lot happening and interesting to lawyers because of the freeze orders and everything else, but yeah, you're right. It got some attention in the press, but that was clearly not as much as Thayer.
Were the things interesting to the lawyers things that were helping develop definitions of insider trading or understandings of how it could be prosecuted?
No, I think that in the Santa Fe St. Joe case was interesting because of the Swiss bank secrecy issue, mm-hmm. and piercing an effort to pierce Swiss bank secrecy.
And this was something that John Fetters.
He did very much so, yeah. I'd say he led the charge on that in the early 80s.
Did that grow out of these cases?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The Memorandum of Understanding, which I think was with the Swiss Banking Commission, was, I think, negotiated in 1982. So it would have, you know, that wasn't that long after John arrived. I think John came in 1981, somewhere in that time frame. And that, you know, is the big issue was basically because the Swiss banks obviously wanted a protocol in place. They did not want every time there was an insider trading case to have their assets in the U.S. frozen. Like, that was not a good way to do business. It was an incredible achievement to negotiate that MOU and be able to get access to confidential information on the Swiss banks. I mean, you really think about it. Up to that time, I don't think anyone had been successful, you know, certainly not tax authorities or other governments, in getting access.
So. And what was the key to that?
The key was these decisions that basically, if you want to trade securities in the U.S. markets, you have to be you have to give up the information that could be that would reveal, you know, wrongdoing by someone who is abusing those markets. So.
Freezing assets.
and freezing the assets was the lever to get the people to the banks to come forward and say who the customer was who traded.
Depending on who you talk to, you get the sense that there was sort of a sea change in enforcement between Spork and Spork.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't. I get long short is no, I would not. I mean, I think there were some cases on the margins that were influenced by the change. There's this big debate about qualitative versus quantitative materiality. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Oh yeah, that was the big deal. You go back and read articles about it, I'm sure, from that era. I'm sure Stanley would love to talk to you about this. I mean, his view was that you could have something that would be qualitatively material to an investor and therefore required to be disclosed, even if quantitatively didn't mean much. I mean, you had a $10,000 bribe, say. Could under any circumstance could that be viewed as something that would be material to the stock? Well, I think the argument would be qualitatively it reflects on the integrity of management, and therefore it doesn't matter that the number is so small that it's a qualitative matter. You could bring a case saying that people were defrauded by virtue of not disclosing the $10,000 illegal payment. And the other argument was, at some level, if there's no quantitative impact at all, then it's just not material. So that was sort of the push and pull, and I think those were the kind of cases. Those were the cases where, Stanley's view of qualitative materiality was sufficient. I think Fetters came in arguing for quantitative materiality.
Things had to rise to a certain level.
Yeah, at least the bribe itself may not have had to have been big enough to be viewed as quantitatively material. But let's say it was a $100,000 bribe, but it was for a contract that was 10% of a company's revenues. I mean, maybe it was quantitatively material just by virtue of the business that it related to. But there had to be some quantitative hook to it to say that it was material to an investor's decision.
You weren't just going to get wrongdoers because they're wrongdoers.
Yeah, I get, or require disclosure of everything. Where did you draw the line? If a CEO was aware of a company made a $10,000 payment that wasn't material to any line of business, senior management wasn't aware of it. What was the argument that somehow the company's filings were not in accordance with the law? It just wasn't. The argument was that no investor would have their decisions whether to buy or sell stock would be affected by that.
Why not penalize somebody for what they're doing?
Well, the argument wasn't whether you penalized them or not. The argument was whether you constructed a fraud argument when there was no, when there was no line item requirement for disclosure of that information. This is all in the context of there wasn't a specific requirement that it be disclosed. It was just quanta versus qualitative materiality.
And it sounds like something that Chad
would. Quanta. Oh, clearly, yeah.
How much of your agenda was being fairly complicated? We sort of touched on how much of your agenda was being shaped by John Shad and his priorities, Fetters and his priorities, and just sheer expediency is what we've got.
I always thought that the 98.5% of the cases that you did because they came in the door. They were there and you devoted resources to them and you brought the cases. Um, there. I think the view again, Stanley's view, I think, would have been, again, he can speak for himself, is that you should use the enforcement program to make new law, to or at least publicize a view of the law that might be novel and unique. And I think when John came in, the thought was, well, we have you have specific disclosure requirements. One should not be novel in creating new theories of fraud. Of course, the irony of all that was that Chiarella came down and said all those insider trading cases that were brought were based on not only a novel theory of what the law was, but something that wasn't supported by the cases. So,
right.
And I always felt when I, by the time I was director, there were a few areas out there where we were interested in maybe pushing the envelope a little bit. I think back to one area where we clearly are pushing the envelope, and that is the in the tender offer area, and trying to where there were companies that were doing these, Becton Dickinson being the best example of a company that arguably was had made a tender offer, but did it in a novel way, so they didn't register, they didn't keep it open for the required time under the Williams Act. And then I remember following that, we worked on Carter Hawley Hale, which was another tender offer case. At least the part of it I worked on was the tender offer case it was a company trying to acquire Carter Hawley Hale, where they had gone out and just initiated a big buying program to buy up stock. So
and this is to fend off a takeover.
No, this was to start basically to take over another company, but to do it sort of in a lightning raid, as opposed to keeping the offer open and giving shareholders a lot of time to evaluate it. So, I have to say, I think my approach was to apply the law as the commission interpreted it, not to premise the program on making new law. In a number of cases, but of course it's inevitable that you do end up making new law as you're bringing these cases.
Well, particularly in something like insider trading, where the law is not written down.
Yeah, it wasn't written down. So,
which is one of the really interesting questions. In a couple of ways.
Yeah.
But you said earlier that I guess it wasn't terribly difficult to come to the idea of misappropriation. It didn't take long.
There are a lot. I remember. Sitting down after Chiarella came down, and people were trying to figure out what do we do next? Do we go for a legislation? Do we go for a legislative definition right away? And I think in my recollection is that Paul Gonson, who I don't know what Paul's title was back then, he was eventually solicitor for the commission, but he may have been like deputy general counsel or something back then. Was one of the people who came up with misappropriation theory.
Right.
Maybe Jake Stillman too was involved. But it was back in the, it was actually one of the in those days one of the good partnerships between enforcement and the GC's office to come up with a theory that actually worked.
Mm-hmm. So by the time you got to there and. That's the avenue you were taking.
Yeah, I think so. Certainly by Foster Wines we were, because that became, that case was the case that went to the Supreme Court where misappropriation theory was upheld. So it's clearly the theory that we argued. I think it was the theory that we argued in Thayer as well, although, again, it was settled, so it wasn't.
In Thayer, you were going into a lot of personal relationships.
Yeah, yeah.
Something you should have avoided, I guess.
I don't know how you avoid it.
Yeah, it dug up some unpleasant details, I guess.
Yeah, it was obviously a notorious case at the time. But that was a you know, that was that. It was a when that case fell into place. It was a, you know, one of those cases where you just could not bring that case. I mean, it was. I think there were five securities that Mr. Thayer's friends had traded on, and he was the only common link. And the, you know, and it was just, and it wasn't all LTV. It was one of the companies, he was on the board of a couple of companies, and you know, and people who, you know, weren't terribly sophisticated suddenly, you know, had bought just before major corporate announcements in five different events, and he was the source. And then, again, it was a long time ago. My recollection is what really nailed that case is that the more we were investigating it, was we got a call from someone who was the friend of Mr. Thayer's friend, who really just laid it out. You know, this is the story, and then it was a matter of basically just bringing the case.
And
it was. I can't remember her name even anymore. But it was. We got a call, and then I remember getting on a plane and going down to Dallas to interview her. You know, just to get the story firsthand, but it was, again, it was a case that had to be brought. You know, it was like no one wanted to bring, you know, all the things being equal, you're in the government, you don't want to bring a case against, you know, another, you know, a high-ranking person in the government, but that, unless the facts warrant it, and that one, there was no mistake. I mean, the facts clearly just jumped out at you. I remember going over to the White House to tell them that we were going to bring the case.
Who did you talk to over there?
Was it Fred Fielding? Was the, I think he's the White House counsel at that time. I remember John Fetters and I went into his office and briefed him, like the day before the case.
And what was his take on it?
Stunned. I mean, everyone was stunned. Never any effort to, you know, say no or, you know, postpone it or whatever. It was, you have to do what you have to do. So,
given the evidence
was just overwhelming. I mean, the evidence, it would have been overwhelming even from on a circumstantial case, and then you couple that with the one, you know, the friend of the friend. And of course, at the end of the day, he eventually pled guilty, I think, to perjury, I think.
So by 84, 85, you must have been getting pretty good at these insider trading
cases. Yeah, I think so. I mean, we were getting pretty good at the ones that we were making. You know, how many cases did you not make that you should have made? No, that was always a question I had. I mean, how many of these cases did you miss? And I could remember one case that was an investigation that went on when I was director. It went on forever. It was like one of those cases where you could not close it, where it was absolutely clear that there was an insider trading ring, and we could never figure out the source of the information.
Did you feel like you had the numbers of the ring?
We felt like we had accounts, most of which were accounts that traded through foreign banks. But we couldn't ever tie it back to someone who would have had possession of the inside information. And that was a big case. I just could never never put it together.
I guess the Levine case could have been that way if circumstances
had. Yeah, the Levine case could have been exactly that way if things didn't, if they hadn't broken our way. And that, you know, that obviously that was the, you know, at least two books out there have told this story about it. Yeah, that was the big break. That was the break that really led, finally, to a a crackdown that was effective on insider trading. up to then, all these cases were being brought, Paul Fair, Wolf Fosterline, and there's all these other cases, and almost no, if anything, it looked like there was more insider trading than before. And then by the time you got done with Dennis Levine and Ivan Boesky and Mike Milken and Marty Siegel and everything, those cases started to have an effect. And the run-ups before announcements went down, the apparent level of insider trading went down. And I think it was effective for some period of time, whether it was 5 years, 10 years, or whatever. But and obviously now we're now seeing another period where memories are short, where insider trading cases again seem to be on a little bit of an upsurge. I don't know; it's nothing like it was in the '80s, but on somewhat of an upsurge.
Well, part of it, I guess, is the scare factor. You let people know that we're serious and we can get people.
Yeah.
Here's what we've done. Could some of it have been, the circumstances have changed? Things were very different, going into the 90s than they were in the mid-80s.
Yeah, well, there wasn't as much takeover activity. But there were some. I mean, and when there was the announcements, there wasn't the kind of level of activity beforehand that there was in the 80s. And I think even now, frankly, the level of activity isn't like it was in the 80s. In the 80s, it was kind of, again, as I said earlier, just slapped you in the face that somebody knew about this announcement, was trading on it before it happened. And again, a lot of it occurring through foreign bank accounts, offshore bank accounts. So,
you talked about why this was possible, because the takeover. Foreign secrecy in foreign banks.
Leverage of options.
Right. But on the other hand, why would so many people take advantage of it at that point? Was there something culturally or something going on?
Well, first, I think the amount of money that could be made was huge, right? Because you're as opposed to Texas Gulf Sulphur, where you tell me what the bump was in the stock price, but it wasn't, or a lot of the other cases that were brought, a company has a good quarter or a bad quarter, people buy or sell stock beforehand. I mean, these were premiums that were 30, 40, 50%, sometimes higher over the then stock market price. And you couple that with the leverage afforded by options, I mean, you could buy $5,000 worth of options and make $1 million. So it was the temptation was just too great. And there probably was something, I don't know if it's cultural is the right word, but it was, why not me? Why shouldn't, who's this really hurt? Which was a big debate back then. Like, who does insider trading really hurt? Why not allow someone who has insider information to go out and make $1 million if they want to? And I think there were, a lot of rationalization that this was not, there's nothing wrong with this, that the people who were selling stock wanted to sell it. So, so why not let them sell stock, and why can't I buy it? I'll make a lot of money on it. There was, I didn't force them to come to the market to sell. So who's really getting hurt here?
Was there any of that in the SEC?
Within the commission?
Yeah.
Yes, there was a little bit of that. There was a little bit of that. Actually, there was a debate back and forth with the chief economist when I was there, Greg Jarrell. I wonder what ever happened to him, actually. Good question. Where, there was a little bit of that got played out. Some of it got played out publicly.
In what format?
What I remember was there was a Wall Street Journal editorial when I was director, which I still have a copy of somewhere. That had a chart in it about the stock market as it is now, where you have, you know, nice, you had a run up before the announcement, but no, you know, nothing went up a cliff or fell off a cliff, to something that was the fully lynched market, where they, which is what they called it, where, you know, the market as Gary Lynch would want it, where there was, you know, went wrong and then there was an announcement and it would go straight up. And the suggestion was that that wasn't a good thing. And I remember John Shad and I had a lunch in New York with a couple of the senior people from the Wall Street Journal, just to try to convince them that, you know, this, the insider trading was a bad thing, and that what we were spending our resources on this was a good thing for the markets, and they weren't buying it. But again, I think the chief economist at the time, Greg Jarrell, had some sympathy for that argument. I don't know if he was full bore fan, but he was had some sympathy for that argument.
Well, and Shad would have brought him in.
Yeah.
I guess the question is whether there was any support there.
No, I don't think so. And I think that's the one. I mean, there were areas maybe where he had some support, but I mean, as you pointed out, I mean, the hobnail boots and was the Shad thing. So no, I never sensed that John wanted to withdraw from that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the drama in your career. I mean, you were working pretty closely with John Fetter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was one of two associate directors, Ted Levine being the other.
So would you confer like every day, sit down? And
oh, sure. John's office was, my recollection is that by the time we were in 450 Fifth Street, it was my office. It was John in the corner. I think Ted was next to him for the time that Ted was there. Ted eventually left, and then I was in the next office. So it was like, and then I can't remember who was on the other side of me. But yeah, we were 40 feet apart.
Did John Stirk come in after
Ted Levine? I don't think so. I think I appointed John Stirk. I could be wrong. I think Bill McLucas succeeded Ted.
Well, question.
I should know the answer to that, but I don't know the answer to that.
How prepared were you for what happened? How quickly ended up in that seat?
Well, I obviously didn't anticipate it. I had been associate director for about 3 years, as I recall. And I was 34 years old when it was the spring of 85. So I was 34 years old. It's pretty young to be in that job. So all of a sudden I was there as acting director for I think a couple of months, and then the director. But there were articles written about how young I was. And I was. I think now, you know. What would I think about someone who's, you know, 35? But at the time, I didn't really think that. You know, it was just like, I guess you always think you're more mature and experienced than you actually are. I mean, but you know, to me, it felt like I'd worked in the area a long time. I had worked on a number of high-profile cases. I mentioned Foster Winans before, where I was the voice of the commission because John Fetters had been recused from it, where we took a lot of heat. So I had, you know, I'd been the face of the commission on that, taking the heat, interacting with the commissioners, and so I felt like I was ready for it. Although, you know, you look back on it, that was about the time, you know, that's pretty young to be in that job. It's basically the time that, you know, you're starting to make partner at a major law firm. So, but obviously I was, you know, it was just a fabulous opportunity for me. I mean,
what did you want to do with that
opportunity? I loved the work. I just loved the work. You know, I loved making cases, investigating cases, and as the years went on to basically broaden, you know, my skill set by, you know, managing a large group of people, interacting with foreign governments, you know, as a result of the globalization of the markets and our need to put in memorandum of understanding with foreign governments so we could exchange information. So, I mean, it was, you know, just a fabulous experience. And also, frankly, getting, at the time it wasn't fun, but, getting kicked around at congressional hearings, just the experience of doing that.
Who was it, John Dingell?
Oh, John Dingell was frequently upset about almost everything that we were doing. And before that, I know it was Senator Proxmire on the... But I got a lot of experience, you know, testifying before Congress. Some of the hearings were friendly. A lot of them were not. And frankly, most of them were not. Even if they were friendly, there was always someone who was hostile. But it was a great experience. And I think a very exciting time in the commission's history, because you look back on on that period. I mean, that was we used to talk a lot about globalization then, but it was really in its infancy. It was just starting. And now you look at where the markets today, and they are truly global markets.
Right. Well, I'm sure it was also exciting because the SEC Enforcement Division was getting in the newspapers.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, for the first time since the media loved the foreign payoff era, right? And so they liked to write about it, but it wasn't that wasn't something that really connected with the man on the street. You know, I don't think anyway. I mean, whereas everyone loved insider trading. You know, it was like, you might have economists who question why we're doing it, or the editorial board of the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, but the man on the street loved insider trading cases.
Because it wasn't likely to say, oh, maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Unless they got in on a trade, they weren't likely to say it's a good thing. I mean, that was a rigged deck. That was an awful thing. So we got a lot more. We started to get a lot more media attention when those cases started heating up.
And I would imagine that the Levine case is the one where
took a quantum. Yeah. Levine started it. I mean, I remember Levine, you look back on it, and Levine's, you know, other than the fact that it was the, was what gave us a key to bring the later cases. It was a relatively, $12 million insider trading case, which was a big case, huge case at the time, but obviously what came later was much bigger. But I remember sitting down after Levine was brought, where people were just staggered by it. Like, you know, this investment banker working with several other investment bankers exchanged this information in the ring, and, people saying, well, this is, the biggest case the commission's ever brought in terms of notoriety, and of course at that time, hearing all this, I think that was true. But I knew it was going to come.
Did you?
Yeah, because by then, we already knew where, Levine had started cooperating and started naming people and things, and in particular Ivan Bosky. So we. I wasn't certain that it was, we were going to make those cases by any means, but I knew that, one way or another, that was going to, we were off onto something which, if it panned out, would be, you know, would make the Levine case, you know, not necessarily look small, but would dwarf that case.
Were people surprised to hear that, you know, Levine had pulled this off, or were they surprised that you caught him?
I don't know. I all. Probably both, you know, just the size of it, all the trades that he had done, and then the fact that we had actually, you know, somehow managed to get through the Bahamian secrecy, which, you know, it's funny, back then I remember, you know, you worry about things that, and I was very worried about the deal we had cut with Bank Loy, which was the bank, to get them to cooperate. And the deal we basically had was, we, you know, gave them, working with the U.S. Attorney's Office, gave them criminal immunity. And although it's, you know, it's pretty clear that someone at the bank knew precisely what the scheme was. And I was, that sort of thing, if it had been done, hadn't been done a lot. Certainly not a case that big. And I, you know, if there were a number of people who were concerned that we were setting a terrible precedent, and everyone was going to ask for immunity, and, you know, what would we do? But
whose idea was it to do that?
You know, I don't really know. I remember the people who worked on the case at the time, and it was, you know, somewhere, someone among the three or four of us who were really involved in it. It was me, Sterk, Paul Fisher, I think Michael Mann, because he was an international guy, was very involved in it. I'm sure there were others as well. Terry Pritchard, actually. But it was one of those things where I was worried that if things didn't go well, we could really be criticized. And there was always the issue of, you know, well, what more, if we'd really, you know, hardballed it with them, could we, were there other schemes or other things we would have learned, or, you know, on Bank Loy, but it was clearly the right thing to do in terms of, like, breaking that case open, and then by virtue of breaking that open, you know, breaking open this whole, you know, the whole thing that came thereafter.
You didn't get a lot of criticism for cutting that.
No, almost none in retrospect. Yeah, in fact, I don't know if we got any. Because it kind of panned out well, you know. We did get Levine. We went into these other, you know, bringing these other cases. But there was I remember actually there was people within on the staff who thought it was a bad idea.
I think
even some members of the team, frankly, who thought it was a bad idea, who thought we ought to insist on getting some kind of plea deal from them.
I guess the commission would be a little more conservative in its tactics than, say, the federal prosecutors.
Yeah, because this is again, there wasn't a lot you could point to where you had a known an institution that had, I think you could had a good case that at least some people within the organization knowingly engaged in, you know, criminal conduct, and you were saying we're going to give you a complete pass. You know, of course, by the time we got to Boesky, and we didn't give him a complete pass, and there was still a huge amount of criticism. I think he pled to two felony counts, or I don't know, it may have even been one, I don't remember anymore. But that wasn't enough, and then the money wasn't enough, although I think it's clear in retrospect that between what he paid over to us and, you know, what ensued thereafter, he did not come out of that as a wealthy man, you know, unless...
He kept some nice real estate, though.
Did he keep it or did his wife keep it?
I guess maybe his wife.
Yeah, I think that would... Because she was from a wealthy family as well.
My understanding was some of the concern was over that period in which he was essentially, you know, wired and trading and closing out.
That was one of the big issues. Whether we, you know, allowed him to trade on inside information. I guess the inside information being that he was going to go, you know, that what was going to happen thereafter. And, you know, it's funny, at the time, I remember there being a real focus on making sure that we did not go into the public announcement of that with him holding huge positions, because there was a concern that if we went into a public announcement of that with him still holding, well, I think he had like $3 billion of positions, that the fact that that was an overhang in the market could exacerbate whatever whatever went on in the market. But yeah, there was a lot of criticism of that, and that was like a lot of the experience I got in giving congressional testimony was over that issue.
That was probably a lot worse than the Foster Wine thing with the reporters,
wasn't it? Yeah, that was a lot worse. Oh yeah, because it was a lot worse. Much worse. I mean, it was demoralizing to the staff, you know, having to deal with that. And actually, we spent a lot of time defending ourselves as opposed to pursuing the Drexel Mike Milken investigation.
So Drexel and Mike Milken sort of slid for a while?
It didn't slide, but you can only do so many things at a time. We're preparing congressional testimony and getting it ready and responding to requests and everything else, and the same people who were in a position to do that were the same people who were trying to do the investigation as well. So,
getting back to the slippery subject of defining insider trading. I noticed that at one point you actually, the SEC actually offered, tentatively tried to offer a definition of insider trading.
Yep.
And it didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, it didn't go anywhere, although, you know, it was funny. It's funny. I read a lot. I remember at the time even, and then thereafter you read things about how we opposed an insider trading definition. And John Fetters actually had opposed an insider trading investigation. I'm sorry, definition. And I did not. And we had a definition that we eventually proposed that I thought was very workable. You know, frankly, it didn't do much other than reduce to statute the misappropriation theory. But we made it absolutely clear that we were prepared to go with that. And it's just the Washington story. I mean, there were a lot of people who were taking a position and whispering in Congress's ear, well, you can't do that. It's a bad thing. If you define it, people will find a way to trade on inside information with impunity.
Was that Fetters' position?
Yeah, but John wasn't the one working on Congress on that issue.
Right.
I think John's view was, you know, that we were doing pretty well in the cases. You know, if you try to get too specific, you could create a window, a loophole. And I didn't see it. Although I think that was the reason why ultimately there wasn't a definition passed by Congress. It was funny. It was one of those things where there was a call for a definition. We came up with a definition. There were a lot of competing definitions.
Yeah, the Senate was
working. Yeah, there were competing definitions. There was, I remember Harvey Pitt had a definition at that time that he was advocating, and long and short, it could have been defined, and it wouldn't have hurt the program, and it would, you know, that definition still would work pretty well in 2006. So I think.
Well, why did it all peter?
Yeah, I think frankly because. As I said, there were people whispering, and I think there were people who were concerned that it was going to, you know, that smart people, clever people would find a way around it. I also think, I'm trying to remember, I think this was going on, I think, at the time that Carpenter was pending before the Supreme Court. That would be just you look at the chronology of that and see that, and I think it may have been that once Carpenter came down, effectively blessing misappropriation, that that it went away for that reason. It was pretty clear that the Supreme Court had signed off on something. So.
Well, a couple more questions.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go about quarter of. So.
Okay, great. How much of your time were you devoting to these things, the Levine case, the Boesky case, and all these insider trading cases? Obviously there was other stuff for enforcement to do.
Yeah, but I was devoting a lot of my time to them. I want to say, probably from, the spring of 86 to the spring of 89, when we finally settled Drexel, I bet 30% of my time. Because it may have been higher, because there's still all the other cases that were going through the commission, and then management responsibilities and working with our regional offices and everything else. But I was very involved in those cases. There wasn't much that happened without me touching it. So
was there any fundamental change in the way you were handling these cases, either in the investigation or even in explaining them to the public or the commission, from the early 80s to the late 80s? This must have been a heck of a learning
period. Well, I think what happened was we got the Southern District of New York interested in these cases, and they became a partner with us. And that's really what Levine and Boesky. We worked very closely with Charlie Carberry in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and it was the threat of spending time in jail that really got people in a cooperating mode. And I think we had a good working relationship where decisions could be made pretty quickly, as opposed to like going through main justice and writing up a lot. It was a question of having a conversation and saying, okay, well, yeah, we can do that deal. Yes, we can do that. Yeah. Charlie, you ought to get involved in this and call this person. And we just had a great relationship. That lasted, though, for a relatively short period of time.
Really?
Yeah, it was a key thing, because we worked together on Levine, then on Boesky. And then there was the Wigton Tabor Freeman thing, and I want to say like February of 97. Well, there was arrests that occurred, and
87 or
90? I'm sorry, 97. No, 87. 87. Yeah, 87. It wasn't. And then, which did not go well. The U.S. Attorney's Office went out and arrested one of these guys. I think it was Tabor first, thinking that he would just roll over on the other two, and that didn't happen. And that was not something that we had worked on and coordinated closely, as we had in all the others, and it kind of blew up. And it without question hurt the relationship between the offices. But nevertheless, we still worked together, and I think that was key to welcoming them in as a partner, getting them very involved, and also on their side, their ability to react quickly and commit to things was really critical.
Now, was the Milken case still going on when you decided?
When I left the individual case, the Drexel case had settled. Mike Milken as an individual was still out there.
What was behind your decision to leave the commission?
I was a little burned out. I knew that I knew after having worked on those cases for 3 years, there was nothing that was going to compare with that. It was like, there was nothing. That was it's not once in a decade maybe like more than once in, you know, half a century that you'd get those kind of exciting cases that got that kind of attention from the media. And so we settled Drexel, and once we settled that, I knew all the action on Milken was going to happen in the criminal thing. Cause, you know, Mike Milken would have come in and settled, give us an injunction, be barred from the business. If that were the end of it, that would have happened, you know, in 1987, presumably. It was on the criminal side when he, you know, whether that case got tried or whether he pled. Obviously, at the end of the day, he pled. I knew, you know, as part of that, he would do an SEC deal, but really the action was with the U.S. Attorney's Office. So I didn't feel like, you know, that could have happened that summer, or it could have happened 2 years from then. And it wasn't as though I had a timeline saying, well, when we settled Drexel, I'm going to leave. We settled Drexel. I wasn't even thinking of leaving, frankly, right after we settled it. And then, like, 2 or 3 weeks thereafter, I thought, when I was traveling, and I was working on some international agreements, and it suddenly hit me that the office was working just fine without me. You know, I was in Europe, and things went ahead, and cases were being presented, and it was okay for me to leave if I wanted to leave. It wasn't as though, you know, I was critical to the operation. In fact, you know, make opportunities for others. So obviously, as it did, you know, Bill McLucas then succeeded me. So that was it.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk with you.